It is what it is. Welcome to the Pre-Dead Boys. It is the award-winning podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, as always, is Max. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good.
You're on your phone.
Yeah.
You're distracted. We're trying to record a podcast, and you're over here on your phone checking what? Your fantasy baseball team losing?
I was sending you a photo.
Oh.
That is related to my fantasy baseball team. Okay. You were just having some bats in the belfry over there.
Oh yeah, nozzle. Some boogers.
You know, one of my pitchers on my fantasy baseball team, I was watching his start yesterday.
And this man has a big old booger in his nose. It's very gross.
And it was there for a while too. Felt very bad for him.
It's very unfortunate. I feel bad for him.
Yeah.
I'll be good though. I'm not quite that booger ridden. I'm ready to record a podcast today. I've got some good news. I had my skulls and our award for our award-winning podcast. I had those in storage at my partner's house, and she is getting ready to move. So I got that box of skulls and award, and now I am reunited with my very pre-Dead Boys collection of items.
Aw, nice.
I had this sick ass beaver skull. Look at this bad boy.
I love how their teeth are like red on the outside.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is, but
they make me feel better about how my teeth look when I see how stained and gross theirs are.
Just drinking a lot of coffee.
Yeah, get your shit together, beavers.
Beaver coffee.
So yeah, I'm feeling good. I'm reunited with my skulls. I'm ready to talk about death. And my understanding is that you have something prepared for us to discuss today. What you got for us?
I do. So, you know, things are still pretty rough over here in the States, I would say.
To say the least, yes.
Portland and Chicago have federal troops on the ground. So I've been listening to a podcast about what it's about what a second American Civil War would look like. And it came out in May of 2019, and we're like only a little over a year after that. And it's like, oh boy, this is accelerated quickly.
Now, I don't like that, because the last time you made a grim prediction on this podcast was back in January when you talked about.
So I'm working at the Ohio State University.
Right.
And it's huge. It's like a city within a city.
Mm-hmm.
And a large portion of that city is foreign students.
Okay. Yeah.
Who have been back for a couple weeks from classes, from winter break. So I've been getting kind of nervous about coronavirus.
Have you now?
Yeah.
And then March went by and we had an entire fucking world pandemic that we're still dealing with. So I don't like when you talk about another civil war in the United States of America, Max. I got to admit that makes me a little nervous.
I should stop bringing that up.
but understandable. There's a lot going on right now that's cause for concern.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thematic root of this episode, I guess. I think it's important to remember that the protests that we're currently having here in the States started out as a demand for racial justice. Mm-hmm. And I do just want to throw a reminder in there that Dorian and I do stand in solidarity with all those protesters for racial justice and against police militarization and brutality. And in light of all that, I thought that it would be appropriate to do an episode on the contributions that Black Americans have made to the death industry. We've always aimed to be a show that lifts other cultures up, and our goal remains the same today. But we don't want you to just take our words for it. We would really love it if you did your own reading about this topic and dug further into the people we're going to be talking about. And so we're going to start a new thing where we will be providing all of our sources for this episode as a free post over on our Patreon page in order to facilitate that. Don't let like two white dudes talking about this stuff be the end of you hearing about it.
Yeah, for sure.
And with us being two white guys as well, if we say anything that isn't correct or is dumb, follow along and send us a list of corrections, and we would be happy to note them.
Yeah,
whenever we receive them.
Absolutely. We'll repeat all this stuff at the end of the episode too, but our Patreon is patreon.com/predeadboys. Again, all of those notes are going to be free content. You do not need to pay for, you know, access to our sources for Max's research. Yeah. And you can email us predeadboys@gmail.com, and we'll mention all the social links at the end too. But I absolutely agree. We don't just want a following. We don't just want this podcast to be like, you know, something for gain for ourselves. Like, we don't really make very much money off of it. It's enough to kind of cover costs. And, you know, I totally agree. Max and I have always been about lifting up the people around us, especially the marginalized cultures and people. And
yep.
Yeah. Anything that you can do to help along those lines gets a big old stamp of approval from us. We totally endorse that and love that. And I think we all benefit from like every person trying to get a little bit more educated on this stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I had wanted to do this topic for a while and always felt a little uncomfortable about it. But I think if there's a time or a place, it's right now.
Yeah.
To be addressing this. So
I agree.
So now that all that is hopefully crystal clear, let's crack into today's topic with the official Pre-Dead Boys crack into the topic moment. For, like, I feel like the fifth time in a row, brought to you on my end by La Kroger Lemon Lime.
And I'm doing Aha Apple Ginger today.
Oh, how is that? I want to try
that. It's really good. Here, let me get, take a sip. Here you go. Here, you just open your mouth here. I'm going to pour it on the laptop keys.
Now my laptop is shorting out because it's shooting out of my headphones all over my laptop. So good is your glowing review of that.
It's good. I don't want to say too much in support of the Coca-Cola company because they'll be fine.
Oh, is that a
my endorsement? Yep. Yeah, Aha seltzers are a product of the Coca-Cola company in Atlanta, Georgia. I enjoy every Aha flavor I've had so far. This one is not caffeinated, unlike the green tea and the coffee ones, but it's still very, very delicious, and I do recommend it.
Huh.
But also fuck capitalism and whatnot.
Oh, buddy. Oh, we'll get there.
Okay.
So for a lot of our listeners, and we do seem to have a pretty white audience, as I think, unfortunately, a lot of podcasts do, Black funeral culture might not be super familiar. We have spent a lot of time on this show ragging on white American funerals and how stuffy and solemn they can be, and also how expensive they can be.
Yeah.
But Black funerals are not that. I'm going to have you read a selection from a Yes Magazine article titled "Black Funerals Are a Radical Testament to Blackness" by Ida Harris, because I think it does a really good job of laying the foundation for what we're going to be talking about over this episode.
The funerals, or homegoing celebrations as they're called in many Black communities, of Aretha Franklin and hip-hop artist Nipsey Hussle gave the world a glimpse of a tradition and ritual that, until recently, had mostly been witnessed from within African-American communities. Black funerals are, hands down, the blackest environment known to Black folks. where raw forms of blackness are exercised. Aesthetic, void of dress code, just come as you are. For African Americans, the homegoing is the ultimate form of liberation. It is one of few black spaces that has not been permeated with whiteness, although that was not always the case. During the antebellum period, enslaved Africans were prohibited from performing funerals, much less practicing traditions that memorialized the dead. This disallowance was in part because of the opportunities thought to be present when the enslaved gathered in numbers, that they'd escape captivity or plan a rebellion. It is also safe to assume that enslavers simply lacked empathy and denied their property any sense of humanity. The American Civil War changed that. Black soldiers and civilians were relegated to recovering, embalming, and burying the dead bodies of other black people, soldiers, and civilians, and thus developed a vocational skill that would not only be profitable, but revered in black communities. And as funeralizing morphed into a viable profession in the black community, black embalmers, funeral directors, and morticians were shut out from the National Funeral Directors Association, moving them to form their own National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association. This led to African Americans being able to undertake and practice funeral services in our own way. Black funerals have thrived and continue to be void of whiteness. Perhaps that is why they thrive. At black services, blind rage may speak its truth to a room of sympathizers without the threat of dismissal, erasure, or harm. Black grief is tended by gingerly hands and hugs absent from hegemonic stereotypes and social pressures that demand strong womanness and hypermasculinity. The black funeral is a mood. It is a radical blackness and love at face value without the interruption of whiteness.
Yeah.
So, I want to butt in just for a hot second. This is very cool. I find it funny because I am a white man reading the words of a black person expressing, you know, very strong statements about blackness and black identity from a first person perspective. But even just beyond the initial discomfort of that, I think that it might be good for us to address, like, there are some elements of this conversation that feel exclusionary of white people. And there are times where I think it's natural, if you are a white person, to hear things like this or to hear a lot of what's expressed, especially right now in the Black Lives Matter movement, as exclusionary of white people or like antagonistic toward white people. I've got opinions about that, but I can like throw that to you. Like, what do you say to someone who just feels like, oh, this is antagonistic toward me as a white person? Big question, I know, but I think that that's a concern that comes up a lot, you know?
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing to kind of engage with for me. I don't really know if I've talked a lot about my cultural background on this show, but I have great uncles who, you know, moved from coal mining towns in Pennsylvania to Texas and have married Mexican women and Native American women. And my grandfather is, I think, like inscribed. I don't know if you know this. My grandfather is the first black graduate of Notre Dame Law School.
Right. We mentioned that on one previous episode. And
okay.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, it's very strange because he also kind of deals with the fact that I think he's a quarter Haitian, but since everything was just super racist back then, even if you were a quarter Haitian, you had to mark yourself as black on everything. There's even a very good, his high school in New Orleans was doing like a student retrospective on Twitter at one point, talking about accomplishments that their graduates had done. And they posted a photo of him along with, like, he was the first black graduate of Notre Dame Law School. And he is very light skinned. He's Creole. The replies on their tweet were pretty funny. But kind of personally, coming from an environment where I am nothing but white, you know, like you look at me and you see a white guy. Mm-hmm. But having to kind of engage with family who is not white, I have never felt excluded if I'm trying to listen to and understand someone. And I think that's a long workaround for me to like get to saying that. But I think there are some aspects of things that can feel exclusionary. But if you are genuinely coming to people wanting to understand more about them and not being like, I'm going to be your mouthpiece or I'm going to speak for you, I don't think that exclusion is going to be felt anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's kind of your experience as well or if you have any thoughts on that. But
yeah, I would agree with that. I think that I was not exactly challenged through like my family in that way of like having people who have identified as black or like had an experience as a minority. I haven't had a personal experience in my family like that growing up, but I have done some volunteer work with urban communities in our city, predominantly black communities. And I think that the biggest thing that opened my eyes there is that there's a lot of sort of already like excluding groups of people as like even the connotation urban community, I think sometimes is used in our city to address like, yeah, those are the people from the other side of the big interstate highway in our city.
Yeah.
That divides it in half basically. And it's like really interesting to see, you know, we have a lot of like interactions between our communities in, you know, in Columbus, it's like Clintonville and the Short North and Grandview and German Village. But then like the Linden area kind of gets excluded or like referred to as the hood and even avoided.
Yeah.
And so do some areas like Hilltop. Like we have these pockets of our city that are very like parts of the city that people tend to drive quickly through or just refer to as those bad neighborhoods. And that's not entirely incorrect, but I think what happens is a lot of people in those communities are like nobody knows them on a personal level. Nobody
yes.
like nobody has like friendships or relationships with people in these communities that experience a lot of exclusion because of not just their skin color, but also their economic background. And I think that that's been helpful for me to realize, like, as I've grown a little bit closer to some people in these communities and understood a little bit more about their life, I've come to realize, like, by default, I am completely insulated from their experiences and their lives. I know nothing about their lives. And I think that that's a helpful place for us to start as white people, that there's just a lot of shit we don't see and we don't know about. And even a lot of people in black communities are really frustrated because they try to express those things to white people in their lives and are met with, you know, ignorance. They're met with people kind of brushing them off and saying, oh, whatever, you know, I think like dismissing it by saying all lives matter is like one classic way of doing that.
Yeah. But yeah.
It helps us to recognize how other communities have been excluded if we are willing to accept the burden of being excluded ourselves a little bit.
Like, yeah.
There is not much at stake for white people to feel uncomfortable as they learn a lot more of what other people deal with on an everyday basis.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, I understand as a white person, there are a lot of times that I'm faced with racial discomforts and I'm like, oh, that makes me feel bad. I don't like feeling bad.
Yeah.
And it becomes tempting to not want to talk about this stuff, but, you know, I'll be all right. Like I don't think that like having moments of feeling excluded based on being a white person outweighs what a lot of people in marginalized communities deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, sorry, we're getting really wordy. And I know that like we barely just started your notes for this episode, but I feel like that's a common response from a lot of people I know in my life is just as soon as you start talking about racial differences, especially in America, there's an immediate defensiveness that comes from, I feel now like I'm being attacked. And that's just not what's happening here, you know?
Yeah. It's the reverse racism card, you know?
Right.
Where people are like, oh, well, people have been racist to me as a white person. And it's like, sure, maybe, but the isolated incidents where that happens like does not outweigh, I don't know where I'm going with that, but you know, it's that card.
Yeah. It's like you don't need to play that. You don't need to get defensive. Like you're going to be okay. And yes. And our point in like highlighting marginalized communities is not to be like fuck all white people, they're awful. It's to help level the playing field a little bit and recognize the people who get swept under the rug and marginalized. Like
yeah.
when we do that with the people who are the most marginalized, we all benefit from that, including absolutely. White people.
Yeah. It's the like a rising tide lifts all boats thing.
Absolutely. Cool. Thanks for indulging in my digression from your notes here.
No, you're fine. I love that.
So anyway, going back to what we just read, obviously this is a very different description of funerals from the stuffy, stereotypical, somber, like white funerals that we've covered in the past, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The practices that we're going to talk about today, or at least some of them, you know, another caveat to kind of tack onto all this is that you know, you can't just say the black community and apply to all black people in America.
Sure. Like,
that's also a disservice.
Right.
So we do want to say that, like, this is not the experience of every black person in America. And it doesn't cover every black funeral in America. But there is, like, a much different funeral culture that black Americans have that springs from, like, you know, we talked about it in our New Orleans episode, the like the funeral processions through the middle of the city with like second lines and things like that.
Right.
That's what they were called, right? Second line?
Yeah. When I die, you better second line.
Okay, cool. So, you know, all of this springs from the history of black people in America. We're going to go back to the beginning here. And as we go back, we do need to have the caveat that Ida Harris mentions in that first article. We lack a good portion of history when we address black funerals because African slaves were frequently denied the right to assemble by white slave owners. We just lose a lot of that history when you fundamentally deny people a right.
Right.
In the northern U.S., however, things were like a little better. We still had a lot of very sketchy stuff, but things were a little better up here than they were in the South. And a woman named Henrietta Smith Bowers Dutier was able to become America's first female undertaker. So what we're going to talk about next is going to be from a blackpast.org article written by Ewell A. Nielsen, by the way. So Henrietta Dutier was born in Philadelphia in July 1817, she grew up in the city's 7th Ward, which was a predominantly African-American neighborhood. And her first career, she was a tailor. In 1852, she married abolitionist and coffin maker Francis Dutier. But unfortunately, he dies 6 years later in 1858, and he left his coffin-making business behind. So instead of just letting the business collapse and go under, she took the business over and became the first female undertaker in America, as well as the first black female undertaker in America, operating out of 838 Lombard Street in Philly, which is only 4 blocks away from one of my favorite Philly bars, which is Tattooed Mom, although I don't think Tattooed Mom was around at the time in 1858.
Yeah, probably not. Still a cool bar today, though.
Yeah. So Dutier wasn't just an undertaker. Her position working with coffins, which are, you know, specifically designed to fit human bodies and also carry the understanding that once they're closed, you're not going to open them back up, allowed her to do some pretty cool stuff. You guess what that pretty cool stuff was?
I'm drawing a blank. Help me. Help. No. Help.
So she was in the North and she had a business where she created boxes that were specifically meant to transport human bodies. She was a fixture of the Underground Railroad in Philadelphia.
I see.
Which is very cool. So here's some more reporting from Nielsen on Dutier.
Am I a fucking idiot that it took me that long to piece it together?
No, you're good.
Like her husband, Henrietta Dutier worked to abolish slavery. She became an agent of the Underground Railroad, often hiding runaways in coffins or disguising them as part of funeral processions to ensure their safe passage through the city. She also supported the African American community through philanthropic projects. She funded Stephen Smith's Philadelphia Home for the Aged and Infirmed Colored Persons, and in 1866, she helped create the Freedmen's Aid Society Fair to assist formerly enslaved people in Tennessee.
And that rules. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's a cool use of your job to facilitate other people's freedom like that. I've also attached on your notes a receipt for one of her services, which you can see. You know, it's an itemized receipt for what she charged for this funeral. And in 1897, she was charging $82 for a funeral.
What does that translate to today?
So I did want to know what it was. I was like, oh, I hope she wasn't like a price gouger or anything like that. So I was comparing what an average American funeral is today. And the average American funeral is about $7,000. Dutier's $82 charge, adjusted for inflation, comes to $2,549.88. So okay, she was keeping her prices very reasonable.
Yeah, very low.
Yeah. And, you know, part of that was, if you look at that receipt, this was before chemicals were really used to preserve bodies. So one of the charges on there is ice box.
Right.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Back when they were playing a bit of a risky game, just trying to keep bodies cold.
Yeah.
Rather than preserve them.
Yeah.
Very fun.
She had to. So as we go on, Black funeral culture kept evolving and building a really rich history. Mostly because a lot of American cities were still very segregated at this point. And, you know, that's not to say that a lot of American cities aren't now. A lot of cities still are very segregated. But the timeline we're talking about is like the origin of things like redlining, which was where cities would systemically deny utilities and services to minority neighborhoods. And banks would be like, oh, if you want a loan and you want a house in a white neighborhood, we're not going to give a loan to a Black person to move in there.
Right. You
know, really sketchy stuff.
Yeah.
These instances of systemic racism meant that Blacks were able to, because they had to, take more and more ownership of end-of-life plans. So if you recall in our post-mortem photography episode, we talked about a guy named James Van Der Zee. He was a photographer in Harlem who photographed a lot of the vibrancy of the Harlem Renaissance. He did a lot of shoots of, you know, upper class Black families that he would show to white people, and they would be like, oh, I didn't realize that Black people weren't all just like dirty all the time. It's like posh white people just assumed back then.
Right. Not the smartest.
Yeah. Because they were old timey, dumb people. And this is an instance where I'm not joking. They actually were just dumb people.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that.
Just being like, oh, I'm just not even going to consider how these other human beings survive.
Right.
But James Van Der Zee also did a lot of post-mortem photography. So if you want to look at some of these photos I've given you here, they're very cool.
Yeah, very beautiful stuff. Like lots of featuring the surroundings too, and the beautiful flower arrangements, and yeah, I love Van Der Zee's work.
There's a third one on there too, which I think is on the next page. You're more artistic than I am. Can you describe kind of the setup of this final photograph here?
Yeah, so it's initially an eerie looking photo because it's a photo of the inside of a church, and there's a choir in the background of, you know, And there's a choir performing in front of a stained glass window, and they are standing behind a coffin with a flower arrangement. And then in the top right, I don't know, quarter of this photo is an image of who I assume is the deceased woman that this funeral is for, kind of superimposed over this in sort of a collage style.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, Vander Zee was kind of known for pioneering this work a little bit in his photography of, you know, fading in these images, these like second or third photos in with the first one and creating these interesting compositions. So the effect is really cool for his funeral photography, where this woman is, it's almost kind of like, I don't know, a angelic or ghostly sort of image in the corner as she looks down on the proceedings of her funeral.
Yeah.
And I mean, now if you see this sort of thing done today, it looks a little bit like, I don't know, like Target photography, photo studio stuff. But I think back when this started, this was like a very beautiful, unique way to celebrate the deceased. And I think Vander Zee's work holds up really well over time too. It was just a very cool way of using this technique.
Yeah, so this is from the funeral of a woman named Blanche Powell, and she's the woman in the upper right of the frame.
Okay.
But, like, you know, you look at this photograph, and there is a lot of darkness on the bottom. Like, it's kind of the interior of a church, and it's kind of, it's not super well lit. But there's just this kind of beautiful imagery of light just pouring in through these massive windows and down on this coffin.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does lean into this, like, this deep religious faith tradition that really was super prominent in Harlem at the time. It's really gorgeous, like you were saying, and not at all like the very dour, somber photos that were coming out of white funerals at the time.
Right.
Where everyone was just wearing, like, three-piece suits and staring into a camera. This photograph has life to it.
Yeah.
And I think Absolutely. That's, it's like super refreshing. And I just want to make a plug. If you can get your hands on a copy of the Harlem Book of the Dead, which is an anthology of Vander Zee's work, I highly recommend it. It's very cool to flip through. So before we started recording, we were talking about the documentary The 13th, which I watched recently. And there's a large section in that that deals with lynchings, which was basically state-sanctioned mob violence in America, where, you know, a large group of white people would go out and accuse a black person of a crime that they probably had nothing to do with, and then kill them, and then the cops would just be like, good job solving the crime, guys.
Right.
Really gross. But black funeral directors actually played a big role in the civil rights movement by exposing these lynchings. You know the story of Emmett Till?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy who was lynched by a white mob and, like, brutally tortured before he was killed. Like, horrific. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, specifically wanted to have an open casket funeral, so, and in her words, the world can see what they did to my boy.
Right.
And so she was specifically working with black funeral homes, black funeral directors, to publicize this and get it in newspapers and to be able to tell people all over the country, like, this is sanctioned violence in the South. That required these funeral workers to know how to present a body in a proper way where newspapers would run the photograph without just being like, this is too violent to run, you know?
Yeah. Very delicate balance they had to ride of, you don't want to sugarcoat what was a heinous act of violence by making the body look like nothing wrong happened. But yeah, you also don't want to just have this, like, completely profane, raw, gory image that newspapers will refuse to publish. It's telling the truth, but in a way that is not obscene.
Yeah. And families of people who were lynched would work with funeral directors to ensure that their ceremonies were things that were beautiful, that they were lively. What that did was it ensured that the news would come in and see the distinction. You know, they would see this completely desecrated human being that had this horrible violence compared to this like very raw human emotion of sorrow. It really helped shake a lot of white people who had previously been like, I know things are bad in the South. I don't really like want to get invested. When you see right. these photographs, it's shocking. And it shocked a lot of people into action.
Yeah. To this day, it's very upsetting. As it yeah. should be. It was a disgusting act of violence senselessly done to a child. Yeah. And those photos are still very haunting to view today.
Yeah. And the reach of black funeral homes went way beyond just the civil rights movement and things like that. I'm going to attach a paper in our notes that goes way more in depth by Carol Thomas Williams. And it's titled Paradigm Shift in African-American Funeral Customs, Looking Through the Lens of Oral History and Consumer Culture. It's very long. It's her doctoral thesis. And I'm really curious to dive into it more myself. But she's the executive director of the National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association, Incorporated. And if you remember their mention earlier in the episode, that's the professional organization black funeral directors founded after they were shut out of the National Funeral Directors Association. And, you know, it's almost a little disheartening that it's still going on today because this systemic racism still exists. But it's also still running because the needs and organization of black funerals is so specialized. So that's a lot of very heavy stuff. So I did want to put a little bit of a little feel-good story in here. I think it's especially feel-good to me because this is where baseball comes back in. And not just because baseball is also an activity that criminally underrepresents black Americans, but because we're going to be talking about Andre Dawson. So Andre Dawson is a former professional baseball player. He did 10 seasons with the Montreal Expos, 5 seasons with the Chicago Cubs, and 2 each with the Red Sox and the Marlins. He was very good at baseball. He's in the Hall of Fame. And he amassed a total of 64.8 WAR. So that was fun for very few people who listen to this podcast.
Sorry, what were you saying? I took a little bit of a nap there.
You can ignore all that stuff. For our purposes, I bring up Dawson because he is actually a mortician now, which is very cool. He was like a Hall of Fame baseball player who pivoted to a second career as a mortician. And he runs the Paradise Memorial Funeral Home in Miami, Florida. It's super cool. I'm going to have you read a USA Today article that underscores how important funeral culture is to him.
Dawson, who for 21 years was one of the most dynamic players in baseball, winning one MVP in Chicago and finishing runner-up twice in Montreal, has gone from the ranks of the enshrined in Cooperstown to the ranks of the embalmers in a land where many go to die. Quoting Dawson, "You never know where God is going to lead you, but wherever it leads you, you have to be prepared. When this first fell into my lap, I prayed on it. I thought, how am I really going to pull this off without having the background or knowing anything really about the industry? But I wanted to make this as good a facility as I possibly could, and I'm proud of it. It's important to me because this is a product the community needs." On a given day, you'll see Dawson driving one of the 5 black hearses or limos, carrying a casket, consoling families, to even mopping floors on nearly a daily basis. He does everything but embalm the bodies in the holding room. When asked what he communicates to families, Dawson says, "I just, you know, try to remind them that God is in control, and you got to look at it in a sense that this is a loved one that's passed on. We're all going to have to go down this road eventually one day. But just remember the good times. We don't want to remember a person if they were suffering during their bad days. You want to remember the good times.
I love
there
this.
There he is with his mop.
Sorry. Yeah. It's a very silly photo. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I love it.
I also like mops are very tall, and he is like kind of dwarfing that mop because he's also just like a very tall person. It made me very happy to find out that he's a death positive guy. It makes me happy that he's saying we're all gonna have to die one day. I like it.
That is a strange sentence, that it makes you happy to hear him say that we're all going to die one day. But I understand your sentiment, and I agree with it.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, even with folks like Andre Dawson out there, Black-owned funeral homes are struggling. I found a really good article from The Atlantic by Tiffany Stanley titled "The Disappearance of a Distinctively Black Way to Mourn" that talks about kind of the struggles small family-owned funeral homes are dealing with. And this is where we're going to tie back into your joke at the front of the episode, because of the relentless march of capitalism and chain funeral homes. Hmm.
The director of the National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association represents 1,200 members, compared to a reported 2,000 members in 1997. Black funeral spaces provide refuge for the living. A family in mourning can be comforted and understood within a community institution, away from an often racist world. Mourners can feel at home during an otherwise disorienting moment, knowing that their traditions will be honored without question. Unfortunately, the dominance of chains portends the struggles of many small businesses, which contracted during the recession in 2008. Those issues are compounded for Black-owned companies, which are less likely to get loans and comprise only about 7% of U.S. small businesses. Black owners often start out with less capital, as the wealth gap between Black Americans and white Americans continues to widen. Without money for upkeep, the owners of small funeral homes are finding themselves losing customers to nicer, newer facilities, which are increasingly run by chains. Where once many Black funeral homes catered to Black clients across the economic spectrum, some are now located in areas that are increasingly segregated by wealth and race. Low-income residents can't afford many of their services, and as neighborhoods gentrify and see an influx of white residents, these businesses are left with even fewer patrons. Suzanne E. Smith, a history professor at George Mason University, says, "When these funeral homes disappear, you lose all that history. It's just gone."
Yeah, so we rail against the commercialization of death a lot. But if you want another reason, here it is.
Right. And it's important to note that when we're saying man, fuck capitalism, it's not just like an impulsive left-wing sort of response. It's that we continue to see just a lot of people get swept aside and like wiped out by things like this, by like big chain businesses. I felt like when we played and discussed A Mortician's Tale, that was a really good example of that, of like you start seeing the humanity removed from these sorts of conversations when a company is just trying to drive up sales. They're trying to, you know, subtly strong arm families into picking other funeral options that are more economically viable for the business. Mm-hmm. Just all of these like little nuanced things that make all the difference in the world for grieving communities, it just gets wiped out. Obviously here, Black communities are no exception to that, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think that line, mourners can feel at home during an otherwise disorienting moment, knowing their traditions will be honored without question. I think that really underscores, you know, why it's important to have people running these things who are in the community and not just like a big box coffin store.
Yeah.
Who's like, you're meeting with the funeral director and they're like, I got another family coming in like an hour. Like, we got to make this a little snappy, you know?
Right.
And not all big box funeral directors are, I feel, I don't know, I probably shouldn't even call them big box. not all chain funeral directors are like that, but you know, I think when you feel that pressure from above, like an owning company, to sell and upsell as much as you can, I think you really do start losing a lot of that.
Yeah, I agree. You can call them big coffin businesses. How about that?
It's probably the more proper term for a box.
Yes.
So this lost history and this problem of losing really important Black American history isn't just localized to funeral homes. It extends to grave sites and cemeteries as well. I'm going to have you quote here from a Medium article by Morgan Jerkins titled "Black Cemetery Loss is a National Crisis."
It was in 1945 when Zora Neale Hurston wrote a letter to W.E.B. Du Bois to ask if he would help to secure 100 acres for a Black cemetery in Florida. In it, she writes, "Let no Negro celebrity, no matter what financial condition they might be in death, lie in inconspicuous forgetfulness. We must assume the responsibility of their graves being known and honored." Up until the 1950s, 90% of American cemeteries enacted some kind of racial restrictions. Even in death, there was a spatial segregation to remind the living that the dead could not be united in their final resting places. But even the Black souls who have transitioned do not have their corpses dignified well after they are gone. Desecration abounds. Cemeteries underwater, cemeteries hidden underneath sprawling golf courses, cemeteries inaccessible to those whose relatives are buried there because they are tucked within gated communities called plantations. Black cemeteries require strategy, community organizing, money, and, of course, remembrance of who dwells underneath the soil. There is ample evidence to show our assessments of Black life, death, and the afterlife are bound by man-made racist enactment where respect and honor are never a given. Both qualities have to be fought for by those who would remain and those who are descendants, as Black Americans are in a continual loop of remembrance and present-day living. The past and present are blurred when our burial grounds and our headstones are debased, because we have to correct the past and speak the names of the deceased, or else we risk cultural amnesia and could be doomed to be left undignified in our passing, too.
Yeah. So, if anything, I think this is where we can make like a call to action to people listening right now. Like a lot of other areas of life, the actions we take surrounding death are political. They are policy actions. You know, you hear people say, like, you vote with your wallet. You vote with who you read, too, and what sources you're paying attention to and who you're retweeting and stuff like that. And I think specifically for us, we can support people who are taking radical and anti-racist steps in the death industry. And I have two specific plugs to make here.
Yeah.
The first being Dr. Kami Fletcher, who you can find on Twitter at KamiFletcher36.
Can you spell that?
Yeah. At KamiFletcher36.
Nice. Okay.
She does a ton of stuff with socially just practices or socially just death practices. And she's actually the president of the second thing that I want to talk about, which is the Collective for Radical Death Studies. That's unfortunately not like a collective for people who study, like when we talked about weird funerals, that guy who got buried on his motorcycle.
That was pretty radical.
They kind of lean into it a little bit on their Twitter handle, which is at Rad Death Studies.
Hell yeah.
But their objective is to, quote, decolonize death studies and radicalize death practice. And so their whole aim is to bring this stuff into the greater social consciousness. And, you know, we can make this little podcast but they are a powerful collective run by people of color. And I think it's really important to kind of push our listeners to these folks as well. Mm. And so if you're listening and you haven't heard about these organizations and people, I highly recommend you go check them out. Excellent cool. follows on Twitter.
Nice. I'm right there with the listeners. I got to go check them out and learn what they're about.
Yeah. If you want to be involved in creating more equitable death practices, they also do stuff for jailed Americans, which if you remember our Heart Island episode, I think like weird cemeteries, people who die in prison and who die in hospitals don't always get very good treatment at all. And they stand in solidarity with those people as well. And, you know, there's a lot about this topic that we haven't gotten around to covering, including a super long history of Black women in Baltimore who created like a massive undertaking movement there and really equalized death across the city of Baltimore in a really cool way. But I really don't want this to be the last thing people learn about Black Americans and death. You know, we really do want to push like research more about the people we've talked about today. Go learn some more about this. It's very cool history. I think people deserve to have their stories told.
Absolutely. I think that that's a really important takeaway. As much as I would love if we did, you know, part two or three or four to this episode, I know that in my own life, you know, making the choice to just move a little bit closer to marginalized cultures, you know, making friends with people who are in those communities and trying to understand where they're coming from and their stories and like just trying to learn, taking every opportunity to learn has been really insightful and helpful. And I don't know, like, I don't know that I've done anything radical to like transform racial tensions in our country or anything, but I can at least grow in my awareness of things and not contribute to the problems and maybe be constructive in some ways.
Yeah.
Just taking it upon yourself to keep learning. This is a bit overwhelming because you won't successfully do this in one day, but it's also kind of exciting to know that there's like a whole realm of things that you haven't learned about yet and to take it upon yourself to just get educated about the death industry and about all of the other ways that Black communities have been affected by, you know, racial injustice and all the stuff that we talked about. It's a whole rabbit hole that I do think is worth going down. Even though it is overwhelming, I encourage you guys to take Max up on that. Just keep learning.
Hell yeah.
This is very cool. I was rightfully very excited about this episode when you told me what it was going to be about. I'm really glad you put this together, man.
It makes me happy. Yeah.
One cool thing about a podcast format is that we are not creating an academic, like, airtight document that cannot be challenged or anything like that. Quite the contrary. We are very excited to have a community of people that we interact with over this stuff. And I think with this episode in particular, it would be really cool to hear your guys' thoughts and opinions. And if there are corrections that you see or just anything like that, like, we really value the community that we have here. And we would really appreciate it if you guys reached out to us with any kind of communication on this. Just what's on your mind? We want to hear from you. Email us predeadboys@gmail.com. We are at predeadboys on Twitter and Instagram. We have a Facebook group. If you just search Pre-Dead Boys Podcast, you'll find that. And if you want to join our Discord, which is very active with serious conversations about death and the death industry, but also I had a conversation about some Nintendo Switch games with some people on there today, and we're always sharing cute animal photos and having some lighthearted, friendly conversations as well. It's a good place to be. Message us on one of the aforementioned outlets if you want an invite to that. But yeah, I can't encourage you guys enough to reach out to us and just talk to us about this episode and whatever your thoughts may be. We would really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you guys for listening to this episode. If you want to support the podcast, follow us on those social media channels. Also, we have a Patreon if you would like to financially support our podcast. You sign up for a monthly pledge of $1 or $5 a month or whatever amount you want, and you get some goodies in return. We want to give a shout out to our new patrons, Esty, Lil Mickey P, and Shannon. Ooh. Thank you guys so much for everybody signing up for the Patreon this past month. Again, we're going to post show notes for free for anybody who goes to our Patreon page. But if you donate money, you will get access to some things like wallpapers for your phone and desktop. And we also do monthly bonus episodes where we talk about a death positive perspective on different movies and video games and books and stuff like that. Our most recent episode, we talked about Evil Dead. If you are looking for a lighthearted, maybe mindless sort of escape from some of the heavy stuff we talk about, that might be a good place to start. Because, oh boy, yeah. is that movie ridiculous? but yeah, go check out our Patreon. Again, patreon.com/predeadboys. Consider donating, but even if you don't, we're going to have some cool stuff on there very soon for you for free consumption. You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. That helps us go up in the rankings a little bit. That's pretty cool. The single biggest thing that you can do to help us out with this podcast and what we do is just share this with your friends. Share it on social media. Tell a friend about your favorite episode that you want them to listen to. We don't advertise. We don't want to. We would appreciate just the word of mouth spreading that you guys have already been doing. We really appreciate that. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by Brat Curse. Good hometown heroes, Brat Curse. Yeah. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com or just look up Brat Curse on Spotify and listen to them. They're really fun. They're really good. That's all the boring formal stuff I've got to say. My stomach has been growling. I don't know if it's picked up on the microphone at all, but I'm going to go eat some food. Max, what are you about to do?
Shower. It's very hot right here. I'm going to shower.
You guys haven't seen this, but on the Zoom call here on the video, Max has been like not just unbuttoning his shirt seductively, but also like,
well,
his
you don't
shirt,
have to
like rings. I would say it's seductive. I'm telling your wife.
That's she hasn't come in here yet, so that's probably just good.
Just hit her with that, and I'm sure she'll be much more enthused about it than I am.
Or mad that I'm just zooming with you and like wiggling my shirt all around.
Just ignoring her.
Yeah. Look at these big stains I got on.
Ew, go hang out with your wife. I'm done with you. Yeah. Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're gonna ride. Sick. How's your fantasy baseball team doing?
Right now they are 0-2.
That's
so
bad.
Not good. That's not, well, that's fine.
They're doing a very bad job.
Cesar Hernandez and Jonathan VR have done not a great job today.
Those are names that sound like losers.
Well, they're both people of color, so I guess if you want to call multiple people of color losers.
Don't turn this into something that's not. You can be a loser, any race, any color, any creed, any sexual orientation or gender. You can be a loser in all sorts of shades and stripes. So don't fucking test me.
Who got
I'm an equal opportunity hater.